Blog Talk Radio.
Well, I've had one too many cigarettes burning up my lungs. Had to taste of one too many lips hanging off my tongue. Oh, oh, oh. Oh, oh. Sunday morning getting high, drinking here alone, thinking up a brand new alibi for not coming home. Oh, oh.
People who, like the founder of this show, recognize if they are on a dangerous path and make the difficult adjustment to be an amazing person, share poems that reveal the duality of our vulnerability and strength, capture the internal battle of the demon and angel on your shoulders, deep poetry, thoughtful commentary, and fun chatter for sinners, saints, and everyone in between. I'm Afaziana, and with me I have Babbler. Hello, Babbler. How are you?
Hey, hey. I'm doing all right. I had a very productive day today, which helped. Also officially closed on buying a house.
Really? That's so exciting.
Yeah, so I got a house today. I mean, I already own a house, but it's my new house, so I'm very excited about it. So I can tease on Monday.
That's amazing. I'm so jelly. I have never owned anything, so I'm just like, all right, I'm going to go move in with Babbler now. No, that's great.
There's room. It's a 5-bedroom.
For real? Oh, my God.
Yeah, it's a 5-bedroom, 3-bed house, 3-bath house. Yeah. It's a big
that
house.
That is amazing.
Oh,
wow.
It's crazy. It's crazy.
Now I'm extra jealous. That's so good. I'm really happy for you.
I'm excited. I'm happy too. I'll eventually stop being anxious and be entirely happy, but for the moment I'm a mix because, you know, I'm weird.
Yep. Big life changes, I understand.
But how are you doing?
Much better than last week. I can breathe, which is always a good thing. for those of you who don't know, I had COVID last week. I'm declared not contagious anymore, so I've left the house for 2 days, which is, like, different because I've been in quarantine, like, not even seeing my husband. So it's I'm back in the world, but still sleeping most of the time, so not really. But I made it, so yay. for those of you who don't know, we are on allpoetry.com, and we are in the group Late Night Poets. And you don't have to be in the group to participate, but it's more fun if you are, because you can follow along and read the poems with us. We actually have our caller already, and this is DJigs, and they entered the contest. So welcome. I'm going to take you off hold now. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Congratulations on the house.
Oh, thank
Yay,
you.
Babbler.
Welcome.
Yeah, you can just call me Doug. That's just my initials.
Doug, okay. I was like, I'm not sure how to pronounce this. Okay. Yay.
That's the first time I've heard it pronounced the jigs. I'm going to remember that now.
I managed to
use it as a nickname.
Yeah, you could be, you know, it's your new name. Sometimes my mispronouncing things just ends up, we roll with it. I know my name is a bit tricky because my username is Aphasiana, and people always call me, like, many different things. Did you look it up?
Yeah, I did. All it's right. Very, very clever, good name.
Thank you. Our contest this week was about conscience. So I had a few quotes that were there for inspiration. The quotes were, "A clear conscience is the sure sign of a bad memory," by Mark Twain. "He who sacrifices the conscience to ambition burns a picture to obtain the ashes," which is a Chinese proverb. "A clear conscience is for me an occupied conscience. Never empty the conscience of a man at work until his last breath," which was Gaston Bush. My eyes are not working. I'm sorry. I can't see the quote. I'm apparently not well yet. I can't see that writing. I'm sorry. "When you battle with your conscience and lose, you win," by Henry Youngman. So I'll have to look up prompt number 3 once my eyes are working again. Sorry. So why don't we start with our guest. Doug, I'm going to put your poem up so everyone can read along. Here we go.
The first and the last quote were the inspiration.
Excellent.
All right.
We're ready when you are.
All right. It's called Heavenly Bliss. Heavenly Bliss, shooting at goal, a miss. Yes. Striking the mind, realizing life, never mind, forget this. A retry, despite, implying, ignoring again. Sizzling, a fry, golden, withholding crave. The flood, overcome, no return, unknown yearn, unknown concern, unknown burn, unknown churn, stirring a cry in the night.
Excellent.
Read.
Go ahead, Babbler. I think you're on mute at first.
First time that I've ever said anything of my writing out loud to anybody.
Oh,
well, it's
an
honor.
Yeah. I really enjoyed the format of this. The short lines, I feel like, give it a really punctuated feel that kind of guide you on to make it almost like a snapshot feeling, you know? Maybe I'm overreading this a bit, or maybe I'm thinking too much about myself, but I almost feel like it's about overeating or guilt associated with food, you know? Because I read, like, heavenly bliss, shooting at goal amiss, like, to not make, you know, the goal that you'd set for yourself and to get really disappointed by that. You know, and then a retry, despite implying ignoring again. You know, like, oh, it's okay. I'm gonna give these another go. And then that, let's see, sizzling, frosting, withholding, Dave, like, on your eat thing that you want. And then I feel it's funny because, like, churn. I feel like it's like almost feeling sick about it, you know, and then crying because you didn't, you didn't have the willpower to do what you wanted to do, and having like self-blame about that in some way. That's kind of what I get from it. But I really enjoyed the piece. I love, again, like that punctuated structure kind of guiding you through as the poem progresses. So excellent, right? And thank you so much for sharing with us, Doug.
Of course.
Okay,
the other one.
You're welcome.
I agreed. I liked the short lines. It helps break it up, so you're thinking about each little bit of everything, having that slight pause in between. I really liked the part that it's talking about retrying, because I think a lot of times our conscience makes us kind of go back and think about how we could have done things better. And it's that little voice that's telling you, like, well, why didn't you do that? Or why did you do that? And so there's that kind of feeling that you have to go back and make things right somehow. And withholding the crave, no matter what that crave is, because it's often a bad habit that we crave. You know, we crave being with people who we shouldn't be with, or like Babler said, eating things we shouldn't. Like, craving is often a temptation for something that we don't think that we should have. And it's like about what part of you wins. So I think that works well, no matter what kind of craving it is, as something that's inspired by conscience, because your conscience is the thing that tells you maybe you shouldn't. I can't say I have good willpower in any sense, so I'm not listening very well. But I think this is nicely done. And I like the repetition at the end of unknown, because the unknown is such a big concept and can be very scary in many ways. And unknown yearn, unknown concern, unknown burn, unknown churn, the repetition really gets that sinking in. So thank you so much for calling in and for letting us use your poem. I really appreciate being the first place where you're reading it out loud.
Thanks for giving me the platform. And
of course.
I do want to say that it has nothing to do with food.
No.
Do you
want me then?
Babbler's hungry.
It's just about not being able to confront your demons and willingly pushing it back, whatever it may be.
I like that.
And I used the churn and stirring mix at the end as just a, you know, words that go together, churn and stir.
Nice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was. I didn't think anything about food while writing this.
all I mean, put ourselves into what we read.
I love hearing what my writing makes people think about, because I intentionally try to make it ambiguous.
Yeah, I love that about poetry, that it can be interpreted different ways, and it's fun to hear what different people think about it. I don't know if you can see the board in Late Night Poets, but E.J. Cool says, great read and write, and the thoughts that plague us in the night. So it's nice to see you on the board, E.J. Our next poem
I don't have the board up.
That's okay. You don't have to. I just thought you might want to know. E.J. is commenting. To prompt one, a clear conscience is the sure sign of a bad memory. We have a poem by Daniel Deschino, and Daniel's not here, so I'm going to read it for him. And here we go. Apple on Knife's Edge by Daniel Deschino. Selfishness. No more evil or destructive creature ever walked this earth. Breathes in weakness and innocence, breathes out with fires of wanting and desire, craving the color of its eyes, lust the feel of its skin. But most deadly, it is invisible. It is only seen through its victims as it takes hold deep within their minds, claim its new home, procreates through the mindless host Gollum and all it touches. So easily they gave in. So easy to not care, so easy to think inward and please the new master. Yet happy they are with their blind, selfish obedience. And now that I'm free, oh, how I suffer from the knowledge of good and evil, the root that grows to an endless branching tree. So much to take in this world. Why do I get some? So much pain. Why should my pleasure be the counterbalance to the rest of the fulcrum would be to join among separation? And I pray at night for a field in the earth overgrown as selfish dominance darkness covers and air is choked. At night I dream a world of pure absolute selfishness. But what would the point of the selfless be? It is too late for me. I already know. I already understand. I can't go back to slavery. And that fulcrum on which we all ride, impossible to stand together. There is no middle, no flooring for foundation. My morning prayer is for its total destruction from existence, from possibility, and mostly from memory. Level ground to be the only machine. And poem.
Great read, Faziana. Wow, you know, this was a really interesting write, you know. First of all, I really love the title, The Apple on a Knife's Edge. You know, you just picture, I picture when you're holding an apple and you're about to cut into it, and that kind of rocking of the blade of a knife before you, like, really push it in to cut the apple. There's something kind of satisfying about it, and that's kind of what I picture. You know, and of course, there's a biblical references to this, you know, with the apple, you know, and looking at the apple and wanting it. And then eventually taking it and then realizing basically it's kind of like pulling open a curtain, you know, to now seeing the good and the evil and seeing the world as it is, you know, the burden of knowledge, I guess. In this particular context, though, it almost feels like a very pessimistic kind of burden, you know, like to have a greater knowledge of the workings of the world, but put such a, like, to see it as such a horrid place, you know, and the guilt of that. There are some lines in here that I find particularly interesting, you know, and I pray at night for a field in earth overgrown, as selfish dominance darkness covers and air is choked. At night I dream a world of pure absolute selflessness, but what would the point of the selfless be? Like, what's the point of being selfless? You know, to even ask that, you know, it's like, if everyone is selfless, why be selfless? And it's like, it really kind of begs at the idea of guilt from an interesting side perspective. Because at least for me, when I read this, it's like the people were being selfless because it's the right thing to do. Like it's the, you know, to care about other people, to give, to not worry so much about yourself, because if everyone is selfless, then everyone is taken care of, because everyone's caring for everyone else and in turn is cared for by everyone else. But it only takes one bad apple to ruin that. Like, you know, it takes one selfish person to make that system ineffective. You know, it really kind of throws that into the spotlight for me, because, like, as a reader, I, like, want to protest the line. But at the same time, like, knowing that the narrator is flawed in that way, then it's like, well, then there's no point then, because the narrator exists, you know, which I find interesting. The last two stanzas, though, I find particularly dark. You know, my morning prayer is for its total destruction from existence, from possibility, and mostly from memory. You know, for something to just not exist, for having knowledge of something to just completely be obliterated. And whether that's to go, it almost feels like saying, I don't want to exist, but it's like that act of knowledge, like, or the temptation itself, to just want that to disappear. Level ground, to be the only machine, you know, to just be like the only one that exists. It's interesting because it's like an admission of like selfishness. I really enjoyed it. It's very interesting. I feel like I could turn this over quite a few times before I really picked out all of the bits that I found particularly interesting. You know, just the mindless host golem. You know, just that as a phrase, I find particularly interesting. You know, I just feel like, you know, while discussing the negativity and horridness of what selfishness is, there's like the admission that, you know, they are selfish, and the guilt behind that as a person, you know, and understanding that because you are the way you are, selflessness won't work, and the burden of knowing that. Anyway, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a really great write. I really enjoy Daniel's work, especially how he ties in all kinds of things all the time. Like, there's usually some kind of tie into nature that I really enjoy. In this case, there's a lot of ties to mythology and religion that I also enjoy. So thank you, Daniel. It was a wonderful write. Doug, what are your thoughts?
I'm not as eloquent as you are, but that took me on a journey. Specific words for me, golem and fulcrum. I love hearing words that are out of left field that I just don't expect. And that just took me through a lot. I'm still processing it, basically. I liked it.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I liked those words too. There's something about both of those that really kind of stuck out in particular. Great observation. Thanks, Anna. Your thoughts?
Well, I always enjoy Daniel's work, but I find it interesting because he writes so well from the perspective of selfishness, but knowing him as much as I can, only knowing him virtually, he's not a selfish person. Like, he's so kind and compassionate, but it's like almost like he worries about being selfish and tries so hard to go the opposite. But there's that little bit in all of us that is selfish, and he digs into that so well. I agree with you, Babbler, about liking the title. Apple on Knife's Edge is really great. I also agree that fulcrum was a wonderful word choice. I like when in the second stanza he's talking about that it's invisible is what makes it deadly. And that's the thing, all of these kind of dark qualities that we have within ourselves, like selfishness or, you know, any of our negative qualities, they can be really dangerous because it's not something that you can see in someone. It's not like you see someone and you're like, oh, they're evil. Well, I mean, you usually can't tell on first impressions and don't judge people by the way they look. But it's difficult because those qualities are hidden, and that makes it, like, so much more destructive. Babbler, you were smart to point out the biblical reference of the apple. I agree with that. And it's one of those things where it has that feeling of kind of like the mythic in the background. I really liked, from the knowledge of good and evil, the root that grows to an endless branching tree. And the branching tree in particular, because it's like, if you're looking at kind of like a multiverse kind of perspective, where if things would happen one way, then this would be your future. If things happen another way, that would be your future. Each branch, each decision becomes a branch. So this tree gets split up every time that you make a choice. And maybe your conscience would have taken you one way, but you take the other way. And then when it branches again, you're within that negative track. And so it just branches and branches and branches further. And I don't know, I kind of lost my train of thought there. But there's something about that branching part that I'd like to dig into when I have more time to focus on just this poem. Because I feel like there's a lot of potential in that thought. Well done, Daniel. Thank you. And I see that EJ is commenting on that as well. Prometheus vibes. Yes, I do love Prometheus too. So our next poem is by Rob Azza, and it's to the same prompt. Babbler, would you read that one, please?
Absolutely. This is You Are There by Rob Azza. Why must you turn again me, you finkish twit, while gnawing at my sorrows, my burning paranoia, my crusted sentiment towards the truth, and sully my scorn and darkened my inhibitions with a purring awareness, waking me from my slashing ways, pushing me to recall every chinless act of desperation I committed, knowingly, brazenly. Characteristically acute, I stomp on each furrowed brow bent in my direction, reverberating within my cranium, reminding me who I am, what I stand for, and whom I shrink for. You are there. End poem. I really enjoyed this. The language, that third line, you finkish twit, is such an interesting choice of language. There's something very, like, old school about it, or almost, like, British, or maybe, like, 17th, like, 18th century Boston feeling. It's just an interesting word choice, you know, but to it feels like it's either aimed at a person or it's personifying guilt itself, you know, to just be so eaten up by something, by not having the strength to deal with something. I really loved the phrase, a purring awareness. You know, I picture like a cat, like in the dark, you know, that's like menacing and just waiting to come out and catch you. I really enjoyed that. I also really loved the phrase, every chinless act. You know, just weakness, you know, chinless is such a great use of that word. You know, just thinking back on all of the times you weren't who you wanted to be. You're not the kind of person that you would be or wanted to be or aspire to be. You know, I stomp on each furrowed brow bent in my direction, you know, just like, don't look at me, like, don't give me that. And then at the same time to be reminded of who you are. And it's like what I stand for and who I shrink for, you know, to have weaknesses and to constantly be reminded of them. I really enjoyed this piece. I felt like it was well punctuated, interesting choice of language that isn't so vague that you lose the voice of the piece or the character of the piece. I love it. It's like being haunted by an incident or guilt itself. So great write from Rob. I really enjoyed this piece. Doug, do you want to share your thoughts again?
I got stuck on Thinkish Twit. That was interesting. I liked it. But I felt intimidated by it. Like there's anger, angst in it. And it comes out very thick in a great way.
Yeah, I agree. There's something about the voice of this piece that is very mouthy, you know. It's like almost like saying, like, no, I'm like pointing a finger at guilt. You know, you thinkish twit, like you stupid piece of garbage that I can't get out of my mind. Like to be angry at being guilty. No, I agree with you. There's something very intimidating and strong-shouldered about it. Great observation. Viviana, your thoughts?
I mean, you both already pointed out the thinkish twit, which definitely is a strong part. I like that that's near the beginning because it kind of, like, sets the tone on how to interpret the rest of it. And you're right, it is a British thing. He's British, so that's, you're getting there. I liked crusted sentiment towards the truth. Something about the crusted there just makes it such a strong mental image for me. And the purring awareness, really good use of adjectives. Where is it? There's a little bit of alliteration with Sully, my scorn. I liked the way that sounded, Sully, my scorn. Reverberating within my cranium, I enjoy, because it's just like when things just kind of echo and they're stuck there and you have that spiral of thoughts that just stays there. And I think it was Babbler who pointed out the furrowed brow part, furrowed brow bent in my direction. I really enjoy that. It makes me think of my cousin because he has like the most expressive forehead. I mean, now he's a teenager, but when he was like a baby, he always looked like he was totally judging you. I used to babysit him, and he would just give you this look like, who the hell are you? And he was like an infant, but he has like this furrowed brow, and it's just, I don't know, whenever I hear furrowed brow, I picture him just looking at you like, really? So I don't know, I really enjoyed this, so thank you, Rob. Now, what do we have next? We have one by G.A. Grimm to the same prompt. I'm going in order of prompts so we can group them together because that's just how I think. All right. Oh, my God, I don't know if I can pronounce it. Eudaimonism by G.A. Grimm. What is it that makes a person good? My opinion? Although potentially revealing of my character, one has to be haunted by failure, a specter of the past wrapped in chains of shame, of regret. And each time you might step over the line, we like to imagine that exists between good and bad. You are gifted with their haunted symphony. If you listened, you find yourself once more walking the path of the righteous. I read one time, you might know or meet a good person. I read one time, you might know or meet a good person or a great one, yet they are rarely, if ever, both. Perhaps that is the secret of achieving greatness, breaking free of these shackles. Yet I cannot help but think that this is even more tragic. End poem.
Absolutely read Ephesiana. I really enjoyed the piece. I'm not familiar with the term eudaimonism, but I'd be interested to look it up, but I haven't. but I like, you know, I like it when I meet my mouth is all kinds of knotted up today. I like it when I read a new word that I don't know. I love how that starts with a question, but it's not even with a question mark. You know, it's very rhetorical. What is it that makes a good person? My opinion. Just leaps right into it. You know, one has to be haunted by failure. I love that as the idea of being what makes a good person. You know, is that conscious, that conscience, that knowing right from wrong, and feeling the burden of wrongdoing, you know, as being, you know, a keystone of goodness. I can't really disagree, you know. I loved the phrase, you are gifted with their haunted symphony. Like, those voices in your head telling you this is wrong and this is right, while burdensome, are also a gift, you know, and the idea of it being almost musical, a symphony, you know, like the specters of right and wrong. I really enjoyed that imagery. I thought that was really well done. And then the last stanza makes me think of a conversation that I had a while ago where we were discussing billionaires, you know, and how a good person could never be a billionaire because a good person doesn't become a billionaire. You know, a good person pays their employees fairly. A good person shares the wealth. A good person gives great benefits. And none of those things add up to being a billionaire. You know, so, you know, a really great, ethical, wonderful person will almost certainly never be a billionaire because it's part and parcel of becoming one to not be that type of person, which I feel like is what the last stanza basically is saying. You know, you might know or meet a good person or a great one, but they are rarely, if ever, both. Because great people, the people who become well-renowned most of the time do that at the expense of others. So I thought that was a really clever and interesting way of making that point. And then, of course, that last line, that this is even more tragic. You know, to be great, you have to step on the backs of others. And there's tragedy in that, you know, to not even feel bad about it is worse. You know, maybe great people are not so great and we should find a different word. But I really enjoyed this write. I thought it was very well done. And it was like a nice narrative through a thought process. So thank you, G.A. Grimm. Wonderful write. I enjoyed it very much. Ephesiana, your thoughts?
Well, if being haunted by failure and wrapped in chains of your past makes you a good person, I'm a good person. So thank you, G.A. Grimm. I thought this was well done. I like what you pointed out about the good person versus great person and how you are rarely both because you know, sometimes you have to sacrifice being a good person in order to get success. And that might not always be the case, but it often, it's not necessarily that a successful person is inherently good, which is a shame. And I like that it ends talking about how that is tragic, that it's too bad that the good people are often not the ones on top. It's very reflective. I looked up the title, and it means, in a quick Google search, not, you know, proper research, it says, a system of ethics that bases moral value on the likelihood that good actions will produce happiness. So it's one of those things where you're doing good, but it's kind of in a selfish way. It's like, or at least that's how I interpret it. It's like you're doing good because it's going to feel good to do good, you know. I'm helping a charity because then I'm someone who gives to charity, rather than actually giving to charity, like, because you want to help those people. You want that good feeling of helping people. So it's a bit of a mixed thing where you're doing something good, but you're doing it because you're seeking happiness. So there's the question of, is it truly good? Which is really interesting. So I appreciate that title because it gives us a good context for the rest of the poem. It puts it all into that perspective, which I think it's very clearly in that perspective anyway. But I love when a title kind of encaptures things like that. Can be tricky to find one. So great choice of title, G.A. Grimm.
Thanks, Liana. Yeah, no, thanks for looking up the title. Very informative. And it just adds a little another layer to the piece. So good to know. Let's get your thoughts.
Calm, at peace, melancholy, blasé, but confident at the same time. All encompassed. It just sounded like a statement. Like they just know where they're at. That's all they need to know. And then I like that in a person.
They're very confident. Yeah. Yeah, it is a very rhetorical question. So excellent observation. Thanks, Doug.
That was the last one to the first prompt, so we're now doing it to the prompt. A clear conscience is, for me, an occupied conscience, never empty, the conscience of a man at work until his last breath, which is Gaston Bachelard. I made it bigger on my screen so I can actually quote him properly. And the first poem to that is by Jack Blue. Babbler, I think it's your turn to read.
All righty. I'll give it a go. All right. This is A Night Ballade, Ballad, number 2. Twilight touches any wave, rolling down to purgatory, with its nymph afloat adagio and the lunar lullaby enchanting her or pulling her to the purple galaxy. When the ethereal light dance the sapphire pavain, my dead inertial heart remembers how a soul sails the sea of space in someone's fellowship. The flashback to my sword covers me relentlessly with a showy monster of memory, when the rainbow lights beckon me to love or grace. Would the flashy fantasy be a sapphire sonata if someone's melody mirroring the snow freezes every move of my sorry sword? Let the snowy sea be dancing to the moon. Save the blue profane. End poem. This rite was very colorful in a very kind of cold palette. But I found very interesting as I read to kind of follow the colors along. You know, it starts with twilight. Well, that's not a color, it's a time of day. I think it pulls, like, at kind of a certain imagery. You know, that twilight colored sky that is, like, the blue, purple, that kind of backlights everything into a black. And then to say, you know, the purple galaxy, and then to talk about ethereal lights and a sapphire pavane. It just kind of winds its way through this. You know, it even talks about a showy monochrome of my frozen memory when the rainbow lights beckon me to love or grace. You need to be encapsulated in this monochrome landscape and beckoned by lights. And yet then we go right back into this blue or cold kind of color scheme, you know, the Sapphire Sonata, talking about snow and the snowy sea. And again, the blue pavane. I found really just interesting. There's also a lot of use of alliteration in here. A lot of words like Sapphire Sonata and somebody's melody, you know, flashy fantasy. There's a lot of words near each other that start with the same letters that make, give this really interesting flow when you're reading it. Overall, I think the poem is really kind of coldly beautiful, you know, and about dealing with guilt in an almost kind of depressing yet gorgeous context, you know, to be kind of wooed by a sapphire path or a sapphire light, you know, when the my dead inertial heart remembers how a soul sails the sea of space in someone's fellowship. To like remember what it's like to be in love, to remember what it's like to be with people, but to see that through this blue lens, you know, to have an unmoving heart, you know, to be weighed down by the memories surrounding that. You know, it gives it kind of this interesting cast. And, you know, the mood of guilt is almost painted on with colors. And yet there's something kind of sparkly and gorgeous about it, the way it's described. Especially how at the end it, like, begs to be saved, you know, save that pathway, save my way out. I really enjoyed it. It is gorgeously melancholy and yet a little bit hopeful. So I thought it was a gorgeous piece. Doug, your thoughts?
Spectral, celestial. It felt soft. It colorfully painted a darkness in an elegant way. It left me pondering and somewhat shivering at the same time, but still comfortable in a weird, unsettling way.
Yeah, I agree. It was almost like sadly dissociated, but in like a gorgeous environment. Yeah, agreed. Wonderful observation. I like how you describe things in mood or impression. Athena, your thoughts?
It's hard to follow up with what both of you said, because, I mean, like, you captured it so well. I had to look up Adagio, I confess, and it is at a slow tempo. So that just adds to it to me now that I know that. Thought I'd share in case anyone is as ignorant as I am. I do like to learn a new word. I thought that the colors worked really nicely. The contrast between monochrome and rainbow, I mean, they're so different, and the idea that, like, most of the memories are in that monochrome, but there's the rainbow that is, you know, the love or grace that is tempting to get back to, but it seems like most of it is in the blue. But it's a beautiful blue, you know, sapphire is a really nice blue. So there is beauty even within that monochrome. And all of the snow references and the cold, it is beautiful, but also has a kind of an edge to it with the freezing and the sorry sword. I like that it's talking about someone's melody mirroring the snow. I really like that phrasing. Thank you, Jack Blue, for sharing with us. Oh, and of course, the name Jack Blue incorporates the color, so I haven't really read much from Jack Blue. I wonder if Jack uses the blue color in other things as well. Speaking of blue, our next poem is by Blue Leader One. got blue all over the place. Now, this is called No Conscience is Clear by Blue Leader One. Once there was a traveler on the road to Samarkand. He spied a little boy and asked him, "Son, do you have any regrets?" The little boy answered laughingly, "I regret, I have no regrets," and ran off. As the traveler walked on, he saw a middle-aged man on the road. He asked the man, "Pop, do you have any regrets?" The man answered angrily, "What an odd question! Who are you to ask it?" and walked briskly away. Finally, the traveler encounters an old man. He asks the old man, "Do we have any regrets?" The old man answers wearily, "When death is tugging at your elbow, regrets are useless," and slowly, offhandedly, strolls away. A little further on, the traveler arrives at Samarkand, sits in some shade, eats some bread, and thinks to himself, "Conscience is a load." End poem.
Great read of Phasiana. This piece is interesting. There's a bit, it felt very folktale-ish, almost parable. Starting with a traveler on the road, who comes across three travelers and asks them a question. It's very structured and very familiar feeling. And it gives it kind of a lighthearted touch. And then I like the responses of the traveler, because it doesn't just go out to say, like, "This is how I feel about regret." It's a little more nuanced than that. The little boy is being silly. "I regret, I have no regret." But at the same time, like, a small child doesn't really have a lot of regrets because they don't have a lot of life experience, And then the middle-aged man being, crotchety and mad, clearly has some regrets, because people don't turn from laughing, kind of snarky, witty children to dour and, harsh men, some kind of regrets or negative things happening in their life. And then the old man, who seems a bit more calm about it, when death is tugging at your elbow, regrets are useless. Useless, sure, but at the same time, it doesn't seem like he's let everything go. It's, the burden of a long life, right? And then I like that the traveler stops and thinks to himself, conscience is a load. And, first I was like, it's something that weighs on you. It's something you have to carry. But then my mind also takes it to kind of like the snarky little boy arena, where it's like, conscience is a load of crap. My brain wants to finish the line, especially since there's not like any kind of period or end demarcation there. I want to say that it's implying that conscience is BS, because there's no definition of a load of what, which I rather enjoy. I think it adds a bit of wit and kind of wry, crass humor to this piece, and lets the reader kind of fill in their own interpretation of the travelers and the meaning of what they had to say. So I thought this was a great write from Blue Leader One. No conscience is clear, in the light of even having regrets. Not having regrets is regrettable. So clever, lighthearted, under the guise of an interesting format, a story that feels familiar. So great write. Athesiana, your thoughts?
I enjoyed that it went through like the different stages of life. When you're a little kid and like you're kind of proud of your mischievousness, so it's not really regret. It's like, yay, I was rebellious. And then the middle-aged man, where everything is defensive. Like, he feels accused by being asked this. I think that there's that defensiveness that kind of makes sense for that stage of, still trying to figure out his regrets. And then the older man thinking that it's too late for regrets. I liked the way it said, death is tugging at your elbow. that's one thing to say, that you're close to the end of your life. I like that it had this structure of encountering people on the road, which I agree with what you said. It had that kind of fable feel to it. And I looked up Samarkand, because, again, I was unfamiliar. And it's in Uzbekistan, and it's on the ancient trading route, the Silk Road. So being on such an ancient road that, it maybe this could be set in the past, sort of like a fable. I mean, it still exists, but it's one of those places that you might have old stories from as well. I thought this was nicely done. I enjoyed the way that it flowed from person to person. And at the end, I did think it was a load of shit. I mean, not that the poem was a load of shit, but that the conscience is a load. I naturally filled in shit at the end. You were so polite with your crap. But I immediately went to shit. But what you also said, the other way of looking at it, it's a load. It's a load that you carry, yes. But maybe it's a load of shit that you carry. I enjoyed that. I feel like it gave a little bit of levity to something that is also a poem that makes you think. So I like that mix of the little bit of humor with the seriousness.
Yeah, great observation. And yeah, I was trying to be a little bit polite. I'm not sure why. It's the After Midnight show. I can say shit. But
it was unlike you. I'm like, what's going on? She's being proper.
I swear all the time. I don't really know. Anyway. Doug, your thoughts.
Sounded confused, but uncaring. And very light for such a deep topic. Like a description of life, different points throughout it, their journey through finding their conscience in life, maybe introspective of themselves, looking back at how they used to be, also who they've experienced throughout life, in many ways to interpret it, just like a conscience.
I'm intrigued by your use of the word uncaring, because you're kind of right. Like, they're curious, by all means, about how the different travelers feel about that, but they don't seem to have, like, any sympathy or deeper, like, feeling about it in regards to the other people. They're really kind of nonplussed, especially by that middle-aged person being like, well, you know, why are you asking? Didn't seem to care. So I like that observation. I think that's a good point. You know, he does seem a bit uncaring. Curious, yes. Thoughtful, yes. Sympathetic, not so much. Great observation. What are we going to do now?
Now we're going to get you to read yours.
All righty. This is Caterpillar. And it goes like this. They rise. I can feel them in my throat and down in the pit of my belly. Wriggles whispering all of the things I try to forget. Good times that went south for more than a winter as a gas pedal kissed the floor, fertilizing these eggs that were planted. Each kiss another clutch, a dropped dish I shouldn't have been playing with, the necklace I didn't paid for in goose flesh and lumped throats many times more than the paltry price printed on a sticker. Eventually they will quiet and grow still, silence hanging from the stems of freedom, waiting until an awakening churns my core again, lips split wide and let forth a kaleidoscope of butterflies sailing up into the blue. Orange and purple and yellow, glorious butterflies that'll never return, born from lowly caterpillars. End poem.
Excellent read, Babbler. I just accidentally hung up on someone. So if you tried to call in and you got hung up on, that was a mistake. So please call back again. Babbler, I have a confession. I have a phobia of caterpillars, which I know is a really weird thing to be afraid of. So as soon as I saw the title, my skin is just, like, crawling. So I apologize if my comment is not very coherent because I have, like, a weird thing about caterpillars. So I'm just like, oh, my God. just imagining them. And I feel, and then when you say you feel them in your throat, I mean, I almost threw up. So not because of your writing, just because I have a thing. So I kind of lost myself a little bit, not going to lie. And when you get to the part about them changing, eventually they will quiet and grow still, silence hanging from the stems of freedom. I really like the stems of freedom because, you know, they're hanging in their little cocoons or chrysalis or whatever it's called, and it seems like they're, like, you know, trapped, but that is the stem of freedom. It's when they're about to be released to their true self. So I really like the way that you phrase that, hanging from the stem of freedom. And then it's churning your core, which for me is like churning my stomach because blah, caterpillars. But but I know that it's a metaphor that works so well with their transformation. So your writing is beautiful, but I hate caterpillars, so I'm tainted. I apologize for that. Doug, would you like to comment?
I kind of had the same sentiment about that. It made me squirm. Insects make me feel weird. And at that moment, I did feel tickling in my throat and in my stomach. It made me squeamish. Kind of wide-eyed. And it felt forceful but colorful. But I was a bit distracted by the physical tingling. The throat part got me.
I'm with you there. We are not your audience, Babbler. We the insect
you
fear
are,
going on.
You are. I mean, you know, I don't know. When I feel guilty, I feel sick to my stomach. You know.
Yeah.
When
that
I feel like I messed up, I did something wrong, you know,
that's
and
true.
It's a journey to be able to forgive yourself for it, you know, so I, you know, the idea was to feel kind of sick, you know, that's the guilt, like that's the fresh wrongdoing, and knowing that
that message
you
was relayed.
Anyway.
That's actually really smart. So great plan, but I'm still picturing that. So I hate you a little bit.
I'm moving around right now.
Yeah. No, I love you, Babbler, but and I'm still kind of crawling. So
I'm kind of like scratching myself like that.
Our next prompt is when you battle with your conscience and lose, you win. And we have an audio for the one by EJ Cool, who has been joining us on the board. So it's your turn, EJ. I'm going to play your audio. Assuming I can get that going here.
Fear by EJ Cool. Fear is a vile thing that steals our time away, rifling through our lives like a starving wretch. Shriveled fingers pick over lint trap leftovers, plucking out broken buttons and corroded pennies to stow them away for a rainy day. Fear sustains itself on scraps and crumbs, dresses itself up in shredded rags and faded feather boas, listless and cold of their pomp, proclaiming grand station and means, the wealth and status of kings and queens. Fear is a cunning cockroach con artist, surviving most sufficiently in total darkness. Hypodermic clicking, pricking through the mind, resistant to radiation, steel-toed boot heel, and chemical intervention. Fear crawls with us into the grave, seldom subdued by fond memories or faith. It sews itself into the skin, needling razor wire stitches, fine hair follicles erected by wet whispers, nettle noise nullified, not even in death.
Great read, EJ, and thank you so much for the SoundCloud. It's always really helpful to hear poetry in the poet's voice, to know the feel and to hear the sound. So thank you. I really like how dark this piece is. She just started out with fear is a vile thing that steals our time away. You know, it's such a waste of time to be afraid, and you can't help it. You know, people are afraid. It's generally part of being human, unless there were very few exceptions. So I felt like that opening line, you know, while obvious, it's a strong statement, you know, and then to go through all of these metaphors and similes that describe, you know, the way that fear is just this horrible, wretched thing, you know, rifling through our lives like a starving wretch, shriveled fingers pick over lint trapped leftovers, you know, just like these nasty thing just digging through all of the worst parts of us, you know, our lint trap leftovers, broken buttons and corroded pennies, you know, the stuff between couch cushions, you know, and reaching in for those, you know, as something that eats basically trash, still picturing like the nasty stuff in a couch cushion, you know, like the old couch that your mom's had since you were a kid, that you played on as a kid and snacked on as a kid and were like gross on as a teenager, you know, and now you're cleaning it out and it's just full of all kinds of nasty. As that being like the essence of fear. I love as an image, you know, and then shredded rags and faded feather boas, you know, give such a dreary image. But still proclaiming grand station and means, you know, to be like, look at how grand I am, look at how great, and to be, you know, gussied up in garbage, you know. It's such an interesting juxtaposition there, you know, to see something, you know, described as shredded rags and faded feather boas, but also being, look at me, I'm a queen, you know, like, you know, like trashy and claiming to be better than you are, you know, and then to move on to cunning cockroach con artist, which is a really fun piece of alliteration for one thing, but also just, you know, the way you can't get rid of it, like how difficult it is to eradicate resistant to radiation, steel-toed boot heel and chemical innervation. Like, there's just no getting rid of the dang thing. But then also that hypodermic clicking. Ugh. Like, if that's not the grossest part of a bug, you know, the little, you know, the nictitating membranes and the little hands, like, legs that do all the weird things, that's mine goes, is, like, the bugs, like, preening themselves. Just how gross that is. You know, and then fear crawls with us into the grave, which based on this description is basically where it should have been the whole time. You know, very grotesque, overly descriptive writing, I think, that does such an excellent job of really getting at, like, how wretched and gross the Pinion of Fear is. Beautifully done, wonderfully descriptive, delightfully nasty, and enjoyed it very much. Doug, your thoughts?
It raised some hairs in the back of my neck. It sounds like somebody that's disgusted at the disgusting. It's coming from a broken soul. Someone who succumbed and is sad they can't climb out. It started pissed off, but very melancholy the whole time. Like a black hole. They're past the event horizon. And that cunning cockroach con artist line was amazing. I really liked that. What made me like kind of scratch my arm was the soda into the skin. Ugh. Yeah. I need to turn on some lights right now.
Delightfully nasty bug writing. great observation. Aviziana, your thoughts?
I thought this was a wonderful description of fear. The shriveled fingers pick over lint trap leftovers was a really strong line for me. It makes me think about those times like when you're lying awake in the middle of the night worrying about things you did like 10 years ago, and they're not big things. I don't know, maybe because I have anxiety disorders. I will like obsess over stupid, awkward things that I said at like random times that like, I don't know, for some reason I'll remember them at the stupidest times, and then I'll just be like picking at my past going, oh, and I did this and this and this. So when it's talking about shriveled fingers picking over the lint trap leftovers, it's like, you know, all the big stuff you've kind of dealt with and gotten rid of, but those little tiny details of your flaws, they're there and you're just kind of picking at them. And that's that fear and conscience mixed together of, oh, I wonder if I messed that up. And plucking out broken buttons. And I like what you said about the couch and all those things that you find in it. I thought that was just my messy family. So, yes, that works. And then the shredded rags and faded feather boas hit me as well. Boas are so messy. I mean, like, I've only had, like, the cheap Halloween ones, but they lose their feathers so easily, and it's, like, just gone, and use them once, and you miss half of the thing. So the idea of a faded feather boa, I think about, like, how it's missing all of those little pieces, and it's like you've left a trail of that kind of success and station and means that you used to have, and you're left with like the skeleton of what used to be pretty and now isn't. And that makes me feel like it's not just the boa that is that way, it's maybe the person who is kind of lost that grandeur. Now, I already forget what you said, Babbler, but at the time that you said it, I was like, that has to be the title of something. It was like garbage something. It was garbed in garbage. I can't remember what you said, but it was awesome. So hopefully you do. there was something really great that you said. Pardon?
If not, we have a recording.
Oh, that's true. We can listen to the recording. Okay. Well, I'm going to have to go back because whatever you said, I was like, I need to write that down. And then, of course, I didn't.
I'm
like
not
going to
be able to hear
out
the word picking for a long time.
Yeah. Yeah, it's been tainted now. But the cockroach was such a perfect thing because they are, like, impossible to kill from what I've heard. I mean, thankfully, I haven't had to deal with them. But I like the steel-toed boot heel and the chemical intervention because it's like they're one of those things that can actually survive, like, a nuclear bomb. Like, they're unbelievably resistant to all things. So that fear is a cockroach makes sense because it's that thing that you can't get rid of. It's like no matter what you go through, that little bastard will just be there and be in the back of your mind messing you up. Plus, it also makes me think about Kafka's Metamorphosis. It's a cockroach he turns into, isn't it? I think so. It's some kind of bug. And I love that reference. So this is giving me the heebie-jeebies of the bugs, but it's still it has such a strong message. So I really appreciate having an audio. I like being able to hear things in your own voice.
Yeah, well, that was a great write. Wonderful comments. I need to familiarize myself, I think, a little bit more with Kafka. I don't know much about him, and I feel like I should. Glad you mentioned it. I'm putting it on sticky notes. Things I should check out, but I haven't.
I read the graphic novel version of The Metamorphosis, and I loved it. Actually, I read it in university, and we had to read both. We had to read the original and the graphic novel and then compare them. Personally, I preferred the graphic novel version. Just it's such a visual story, but it's a really great metaphor.
Check it out. Great comment. Where are we off to now, please?
We are going to have an audio by Nightfall Vixen, if my computer will cooperate. It's going super slow. Come on, Internet, you can do it. It's loading. Sorry. But thankfully, we do have an audio for this one as well. A few people who wrote to this prompt sent us some audio recordings, which is wonderful. Okay. Here we go. Nightfall.
Dark finger, I'm on and song, song, R&B, ballin'. See fumes, perfumes, and more shadow. Rolling up in the inbred Rolls Royce cattle. As I'm screaming, yeah, cattle with an air sickle paddle. So that's 23 outcast plus deep gutter, Benny Sludge Mantle. It's a wet up, get up, white beater, cut up in the salt off claws. Fingernails and finger, I'm cooking Chinese dinner. And with cinders, when I'm punished, no longer linger, the timber flex front. Cinder breast drained of the excess and exit the fall.
I really loved the beat on that. And I'm glad so many people are submitting SoundClouds. I feel like there's been an uptick lately, and I'm enjoying that uptick. This was very different from anything else that we've had tonight, especially with it being really more of a rap and a Star Wars rap at that. But I enjoyed the mixing. I'm looking at, you know, I'm going through the lyrics here, and I find some really interesting wordplay in here. You know, to start off with, like, dark anger, you immediately get that it's a Star Wars reference, you know, Darth anger. And then it says, I'm mauling, which then makes you, if you know Star Wars, think of Darth Maul. And then installing Zolin. So now we're talking about, you know, a dictator, a kind of relentless one, especially one that is known for, you know, giving his army not enough guns and having them march into war and, like, pass rifles. You know, so not, you know, not the best kind of sort, which I found, you know, an interesting reference. And it's kind of definitely going, you know, down that dark, the dark path of Star Wars. You know, I found that interesting. I also found the line, an inbred Rolls Royce, very fascinating. I'm trying to figure out what in the Star Wars universe is an inbred Rolls Royce that, like, you know, like, would you call a Death Star of inbred? Anyway, I just find that very fascinating line. My brain is trying to, you know, wrap around it. And just some of these lines are really, like, fascinating. You know, the white feet are cut up into sawed-off claws. Like, to refer to, like, hands is really dark. You know, and then to, you know, have his fingers cut off is fascinating, you know. No longer linger their timber flesh, burnt cinder breath, drained of excess and exits the faller. Even, like, to, you know, the way that Darth Vader is kind of singed at the end. It's kind of like, you know, the turn into evil and the payout thereof. And then to go to the end and be more candy than a pinata on twin yachts. I don't, like, I'm trying to, you know, wrap my brain around the idea of going from, like, Darth Vader cooking in a pit of a volcano to candy on a pinata, you know, and so that's the mental aerobics there. You know, I green eye the keen dye dyed on a silver wire supreme, you know, to want something that someone has, you know, and then obey one is, I think, a wordplay on Obi-Wan, you know, and the, to recount kind of the fates on what happened to everybody, you know, all the people that died, and the way that evil breeds more evil, and you still need the good to battle the evil, you know, to take them on. To end with stormtroopers with railguns, meet my falcon, Halo One, so now I rise. You know, to turn around and battle the evil. So there's an interesting level of guilt under here, but I mean, I feel like it's pretty directly a Star Wars referencing rap, but there is some very interesting wordplay and very interesting terms cooked up for things that I couldn't say that I would probably ever think of in a million years. So I find this a very fascinating write, and someone who has a very different perspective on things than I do. I find it very intriguing. Fabiana, your thoughts?
Well, in the AN, it says, this is about Star Wars, yes, but also my inner battle with good and evil. And it says that he made the beat and mastered it. I thought it was really cool that he rapped it. He is in the rap group that I'm in as well. And I can see why. I've never actually heard him before out loud. I liked the Star Wars references, but I'm a big Star Wars geek. I like that it... it had wordplay. Like, it didn't directly say things. It, like you pointed out, the I'm mauling, but referencing Darth Maul, and the Obi-Wan is Obey-Wan. There were some smart things. For the Rolls-Royce, I could be wrong, but for some reason, I think that was Hitler's car. And the Star Wars was often referred to as being about that, because there was stormtroopers were in the German army, I believe. So that's where this, what the stormtroopers were based on. And like in the original Star Wars, the Empire was like the everyone is the same kind of thing, and then the rebels were more diverse, and it was supposed to be referencing that, the war. So I think that he's making connections there, but I could be wrong about the car thing. And like you pointed out, there's the Stalin part. So I think he's not calling out one specific dictator or culture, but kind of talking about how, you know, our world is represented by science fiction, that it's there and that there is the darkness in real life too. And the Falcon and Halo, they're on the one hand, they're the ships, like the Millennium Falcon. But at the same time, Hale, again, is, I think, a reference to war kind of stuff. It also makes me think of Hail Hydra, which is in Avengers, not Avengers, in the Marvel Universe, the bad guys are Hydra. And they're very Nazi-ish as well, I think. So it's about, like, that kind of darkness. And so Now I Rise, I think he's saying that, like, he's stepping away from that kind of life. Not to say that he ever was a part of that, but, you know, you're I feel like I'm stepping on my words here. I'm just saying he's, you know, your conscience is to not be it part. Yeah, I'm just going to shut up because I'm babbling now. That's your job, babbler.
No, I think you have some great notes in there. And of course, with, like, Halo, you know, Hail Hitler, obviously, like, Heil, but, you know, essentially the same thing. And then it's interesting, though, because Halo implies, like, something angelic. So there's, like, good and evil wrapped up in that one word by putting a dash before the O, which is really interesting. Anyway, I thought that was kind of a cool word to fix that, to look at after you pointed it out. Great comments. Doug, your thoughts?
I have bad connection, apparently, so I couldn't hear any of the words, so I got it going off of what you guys said. But this exact type of music is what I love it. It's what got me to start writing myself. The flow, everything, I can hear, even though I can't hear the words, I could hear the voice and how it flowed consistently. I want to watch it again or listen to it again with better equipment turned up very loud. And also, it's kind of funny because I've been watching Star Wars all day, today and yesterday. And yeah, I want to delve back into this one when I can.
Yeah, no, give it a go. Check it out. Yeah, I do think it's designed to be played loudly, maybe in a pair of headphones.
Exactly. That's what I want to do.
It's intense. But, yeah, no, excellent comment. All right, I'm going to go ahead and read the next one. Well, Ephesiana steps away for a second. This is Conscious Comes After Science by Brundaban Panda, and it goes like this. Contribution of education can't be calculated, costly because from education knowledge made. Commonly said when knowledge systematized comes the stage of science, so scientist head. Common sense of science is called as wisdom. Conscience follows subsequently to the wisdom. Concept of conscience differs because feelings differ. Conscience in spiritual anger, inherent moral power. Conscience deals ethics means what ought to be. Concept of science conveys what experiments give. Conscience for uncertain future, but science certain. Conscience versus science, so science win position. Carefully reading four-number prompt I appreciated, because of battle with conscience, consequence said. Conscience loses status, but the science must wins. Creation continues with science, so universe is nice. Clever human being classifies sciences and branches. Computer science, social science, physical sciences, criminology, sociology, penology under legal science. Conscience is moral. Circumference is center. Science. End poem. This was intriguing. I mean, as I'm reading it, you know, I'm noticing more and more that, you know, the word conscience includes the word science. I also find it interesting the consideration that conscience comes after science. It's almost like implying that science considers itself outside of good or bad, like outside of the realm of morality, which in itself is immoral, because to do science at the expense of people, by people at least, you know, something that really shouldn't happen. But science happening by itself without the interference or influence of people kind of is amoral. You know, it's like watching a documentary, right, where you're watching a starving snow leopard chasing, you know, a rabbit through the tundra, you know. There's nothing good or bad about that. Like, it's not a morality thing. The leopard needs to eat. The bunny wants to live. You know, like, who wins is just kind of life. Like, that's just kind of how life works, and it really doesn't have anything to do with morality. But when you start to get into people playing with science and applying it in specific ways that can be harmful, you know, then science has entered into the arena of morality, which I find fascinating. There's clearly a lot of alliteration in this piece. You know, contribution of education can't be calculated. There's so many C's. Like, literally every line of this piece starts with a hard C. You know, we're talking about the cost of not applying science and conscience together. Clever human being classifies science in branches, computer science, social science, physical sciences, like to break out all these different sciences but to not include conscience, it's moral circumference, it's center science. You know, what's the heart of everything is kind of right or wrong. I would argue that is it the right or wrong of humans, of people? I don't know how much conscience really plays a role outside of the human experience so much. But I do find this interesting, the interrelatedness. They're kind of proposed in here as almost like opposite of each other, which I don't think is necessarily fair. I don't think they are completely opposite of each other. You know, there's a difference between something that is amoral and something that is immoral, you know, and I think a big piece of that is the human element. But I do enjoy the piece. I think it's interesting wordplay. I think it's interesting read. I found some of the word choices interesting, that I'm not sure if it's more language barrier or an intentional kind of offness, like offbeat to it, you know. Concept of conscious differs because feelings differ. I feel like because is shortened there to kind of hit that hard C again and have that internal alliteration to kind of play off the other words. You know, but then other words are dropped interestingly, and I'm not quite sure, you know, the purpose other than to give it a really interesting voice. conscience for uncertain future, but science certain. You know, you drop like an is. You know, there's not the sentence structure is very unique. So I found the piece interesting and kind of wants to put your brain to like piece these two things together and kind of wrap your head around it. It's inherently philosophical.
That was a tongue twister. As an amazing intertwining of words. Like it was intentionally trying to confuse me. Almost, I got a feeling, weirdly, like it was almost like talking down to uneducated people and describing how confusing science can be if you haven't studied it, like how confusing the conscience can be in and of itself. It was brow-furrowing, mind-spinning, and it forced me to have to read again. I liked it.
Interesting. I like your take on that. The idea that the sentence structure, the word choices, is really more to be almost like pompous, you know, very egotistical, you know, highbrow.
I was
going to
say arrogant.
Yeah. Towards, you know, anyone who's not understanding this. Like, if you don't get this, you should feel bad, you know. And that's kind of an interesting take. I like that. You know, and kind of using the language like purposefully to confuse, you know, rather than to help a point or to be more exacting in language, it's to make your reader or listener feel lesser than. Interesting. I love that perspective. That's really interesting. Because, yeah, there is a lot of larger words in here. And the sentence structures make it a bit different to follow. And it is a bit of a tongue twister. You know, all of that alliteration with the hard C's followed by S's, you know, those aren't two letters that are easy to follow off each other. And it does make it a bit difficult to get your mouth around.
Uh-oh. I can see what they were trying to do, though, with the message. Pun intended.
Yeah. So, oh, definitely. Yeah, the all of the hard C's especially, very, very intentional. Excellent observation. Susiana, I'm not sure if you are back or not. Holler if you are.
I just got back, so I did not hear the poem. I heard some of your comments. So I can't speak to this specific poem, but my understanding, based on his previous work, is Brundaban Panda is not English. I mean, like, it's his second or third language. So possibly the sentence structure is related to that, but he's also a doctor, so very intelligent. So it's like great vocabulary, but the syntax of another language is potentially a factor. But
if the English isn't his first language, that's incredibly impressive to put that strung all those together like that.
Yeah, I agree. I think he's in India. So,
yeah,
Brundaban, I apologize. I can't comment because I missed it, but I will certainly read it later. Our next poem is by Arcana Amore, and we have an audio again. Arcana, here you are.
My tortured heart weeps tormented tears as my world descends unto the fiery pit, screaming obscenities at dying affection, whilst demons dance on the grave of love. They echo their words into unseen depths, taunting and teasing with wicked whispers that submerge the labyrinth of a drowning mind, as hope's last flickering flame is doused. My realm bathes in shade from ensuing darkness. There's something within me trying to get out. A void of obscurity now shields the light, with pitch-black palls of perishing promise. Falling further from fondness's fading facade, disguised in despondency and dissolving dreams. I watch as my conscience consents to corruption, as empathy escapes behind crumbling walls. I dig deeply to discover dwindling devotion that once flooded my thoughts with cordial compassion, with demons still dancing on tenderness's tomb, whilst lost in catacombs of creeping contempt. Is this what it is to be condemned to damnation, to lose all sight of consideration and comfort, and submit to infection, inspiring indifference, that crawls a sepulchre of strangled sanity? Then gouged by the gloating grasp of guilt, condemning the soul to relentless remorse, stranded in oceans of restless regrets, ravaged by ruinous ripples of repentance. I pray to stay away from shadows that sway and slay dismay before it leads me astray, nor pay each day to allay this affray, that I may rise untainted from hell.
Thank you so much, Arcana Amore, for the SoundCloud. Very interesting, very fascinating. I was particularly creeped out by the interesting, I can't really think of the right word for it, but the secondary kind of voice, you know, like you kind of given yourself almost an echo that was in a different pitch, gave it a real eerie feeling, you know, paired with the very creeptastic background. It gave it a very strong vibe. So thank you for the submission. Reading this is really interesting. I mean, it really gets into alliteration here. You know, it's just like phrase after phrase of like how dark and terrible and horrible everything is as they like descend into the fiery pit, you know. It's like this deep well of just negative and horrible things, just really kind of grinding it in, you know, just like, it's like relentlessly negative, you know. My tortured heart weeps, tormented tears, the fiery pit, you know, screaming obscenities, dying affection, grave of love, like it just, it keeps going and going into, like, this horrible place of despair, you know, just a void of obscurity shielding the light, pitch-black palls, perishing promise, you know, just, you're almost, like, dragged down into the dark pit of hell with the narrator, just how, you know, on it is with this concept, you know, is this what it is to be condemned to damnation, to lose all sight of consideration and comfort, to submit to infection, inspiring indifference, just, you know, just going and going. And then finally, this last stanza, I pray to stay away from shadows that sway and slay dismay before it leads me astray, nor pay each day to allay this affray, that I may rise untainted from hell. You know, to rise untainted to hell, from hell, you know, to let it go, to, like, please, at some point, like, I just want it to let up. Like, I just want to feel less guilty. You know, it kind of says guilt, but it, like, it also kind of says, just, like, depression from it. You know, to, like, just really hate on yourself and just feel absolutely hopeless. Like, the level, you know, this isn't the kind of guilt that you feel for, like, stealing candy bars as a kid, you know? This isn't the kind of guilt that you feel for, you know, blaming something minor on someone else. This is, you know, it's not for dinging a car door. You know, it's something much more intense than that, whatever this kind of conscious is. You know, whatever this weight is, you know, it drags you all the way down. Something much darker than your minor, you know, I shouldn't have done that. So very interesting, very fascinating, very dark, like extremely, like just, you know, I felt like I was pulled through, you know, the nine layers of Dante's Inferno here. So fascinating, right? Really great use of alliteration. Very dark. So thank you, Arcana Moore. Athesiana, your thoughts?
Well, first of all, it was a performance, like not just the reading, but like he has such great inflection in the way that he reads, and I love the accent. If you haven't heard him sing, he entered my music contest a while ago, and he's a really great singer too. I agree about the alliteration, definitely full of that. I watch as my conscience consents to corruption, as empathy escapes behind crumbling walls. Consents to corruption, it's like that choice to, like, you know what, I'm just going to let go and, like, give in to this. And empathy escaping is huge, because empathy is, like, so important, I think, as an integral part of being a good person. And then later on, it's talking about indifference. And I think that indifference can sometimes be even worse than being malicious, that not caring either way ends up causing so much trouble. And it's more subtle, but it's something that the conscience can slowly miss, because it's not as obvious as, like, purposely hurting someone, but the not caring that something is happening enough to help, then you're really slipping down that slope. So I really liked that he talked about the empathy and the indifference and those more subtle things that bring you down into this deep darkness. Definitely a dark piece. And he seems to be really good at capturing that. Like you said, it felt like we're going through hell in the inferno, which is intense, obviously. So thank you so much for submitting your audio, Arcana.
Yeah, I'm very, very much appreciative of the audio, and very intense, very dark. Excellent comments, Athesiana. Yeah, you're right. The subtleties of just not caring, and maybe those last few levels of, you know, into hell, does not even feel bad anymore. Great observation. Doug, your thoughts?
It's a good fitting that I'm outside in the dark right now listening to that. It definitely felt like I was spiraling. As far as the audio itself, the background music almost drowns them out, but I think that's kind of the point of the artistic purpose. It was whispering, but deafening. The conscience consents to corruption line, that one, and it was really the catacombs, quainting contempt. Those two really got me. It was almost like it was written in a cemetery. Written in a cemetery by listening to the demon on the shoulder talking. I'm going to have to watch some cute cat videos afterward to lift myself back up now.
Who doesn't want to watch two cans? It's always a pick-me-up. Better than chocolate. very dark. I agree. I can see that, sitting out in the dark in a cemetery, feeling inspired. So, great comment, great observation. Where are we off to now, Faziana?
We now have Why of the Why by Paul Thomas One. Conscience nor soul acknowledged, first four of seven decades, poems written woes and foes, remembering only our pains. How was I, as child, lovable or constant problem? No love nor affection for women sharing their lives with me. Alcohol and escapist acts, rather than confront realities, life designed for maturing, depression, despair, betrayals. No women today mentally, emotionally stronger than I ever will be. Pain has been experienced, physical and self-induced. Many people dispense it, intended or not. When words and thinking centrist, no regards for harm or outcome, conscience a spiritual gift through conception and beyond. End poem.
Great read, Faziana. Really interesting. I love how it starts out with conscience nor soul acknowledged, first four of seven decades. Makes me think that, for the first 40 years of said life, they didn't feel bad about anything that they did, and they didn't even acknowledge that they had a soul, maybe that means they found religion later in life, or maybe they just realized that they do care, later. They talk about their woes and foes, remembering only our pains, the selfish despair. How was I as a child, lovable or constant problem? That one almost made me smile, because I was both. My mom and siblings frequently remind me of what a pain in the ass I was as a toddler for so many years, because I was unusually precocious, so I could walk and talk from a really young age, which made me unusually capable. However, I still had the emotional development of a child my age, so, very I don't give a fuck kind of attitude, but capabilities far beyond my years, my family did not appreciate. But I like to think I was still lovable, at least, hopefully. And then no love nor affection for women sharing their lives with me. I really like the phrase women sharing their lives with me, because it takes it, even beyond the romantic. Not just lovers, not just people you're dating or married to or seeing romantically, but your mom. Your siblings, your aunts, your grandmother, cousins, just really not giving a shit about any of the women in your life. And then falling to alcohol and escapist acts, just being rebellious, and not owning up to anything. It was very interesting. And then realizing that, you ain't shit compared to some of the women that you know. And kind of that owning up and that growth and becoming mature, really. And then that end, conscience is a spiritual gift through conception and beyond, caring about other people and feeling bad about doing bad things is a good thing, because that's how you know how to choose the right thing. I thought this was a really interesting poem, to really kind of pull from more of a... or at least write it in a very introspective voice, of personal growth, at least in the framing of this narrator, regardless of, how true it may or may not be. So, interesting, right? I enjoyed it. Faziana, your thoughts?
In the AN, it says it's inspired by the 12-step program. So I think that's referring to AA or maybe NA. It makes sense to me that you would think about that, because I think part of AA is you think about who you may have harmed and you make amends. So to wonder about, you know, how he may have affected people as a child, who the women in his life who he may have mistreated or not appreciated. And I like what you said, Babbler, about how it could be, you know, any kind of woman in different aspects of his life. But also I note that it's women sharing their lives with me. It's not like they the fact that he was in a relationship with them, because maybe he wasn't sharing his life with her. Maybe he wasn't giving, he was only taking. So the women sharing their lives with me kind of acknowledges that they were the ones sharing. And it acknowledges the alcohol and escapism. And then recognizing the faults and how your conscience is a gift that lets you change things. I thought this was a very thoughtful, kind of self-reflective piece. And like you said, whether it is personal or not, because we never know when someone's writing a poem if it's, you know, about themselves or if they're playing that character. But I like that he shares in this that it was connected to AA, because it helps give that that framing. So first I read it, and then I read that, and then I read it again, and it gives you perspective on things.
Yeah, it does give perspective, because I think we kind of walked through those 12 steps in here. You know, they're not perfectly delineated, but like, for example, I know that the first step of the 12-step program is to acknowledge a higher power, and I think that like immediately acknowledged here, you know, conscience nor soul acknowledged, to acknowledge that you have a soul is to kind of give nod to higher powers. I think that's a great observation. Thanks for reading the AN, Tatiana. Doug, your thoughts?
This one kind of hit a little close to home. The alcohol escapism is very much known to me. It's kind of a problem I've been going through, have in the past. I get the whole tone of everything. It's melancholy and self-introspective, like someone who's been searching for a long time without knowing they were. And there's sadness, but there's also almost like disdain, but not intense, but just discovering themselves.
Great observation, yeah. No, I see what you mean, you know, to like look at yourself and see that you're not who you were, and regret kind of mixed with distaste. Excellent observation. Well, I think we've got 2 minutes left with Asiana. Anything you want to say before we call it a night?
Well, just that we have about 7 carryovers. So if you're listening and you thought your poem was going to be read tonight, it will be next week. It's not that we have excluded it. So thank you, everyone, who contributed their writing. And we're going to explore this topic more next week. I appreciate all of the writing and audios. This is all about your poetry. And thank you so much, Doug, for calling in. It's great to have you here, and you're always welcome to call again. Babbler, you're awesome. Thank you for filling in the last 2 weeks while I was sick. And Pam, shout out to Pam, who filled in last week.
Mm-hmm.
And Pam's birthday is coming up soon, so check out the Duke of St. Paul, Dex Bailey's contest for Pam, because we are going to celebrate Miss Pam Ray and have a party on the next Double Helix show. So all of our listeners who love Pam, write for Pam. Thank you so much, Phil, for giving us this show, and we will see you next week. Bye, everyone.
See you next week.
Thank you.